ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Look, as you know, while Phil's been away, while you've had me sitting in the hot seat here chatting to you across nightlife, what I've been doing is taking the time to just have a bit of a chat with some of the incredible political reporters that we've got right around the country to find out some of the absolutely top stories that were coming out of their states, their territories, their cities and their areas, looking back on the world that was 2025. Tonight, something quite close to me, actually, where I started my ABC career back in 2018. Charlie Mills is with ABC Pilbara in Karratha in WA. Charlie, thanks for taking a bit of time to chat on Nightlife.
G'day, Nick. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you can't talk that sort of top end that you're in, that sort of beautiful Pilbara area, without having a bit of a chat about cyclones. I have been there for one back in Victoria's day. And, of course, as we speak, Tropical Cyclone Hayley is sitting northwest of Broome. Category 1 system at the moment. We'll be obviously keeping a very close eye on where it looks to go in the next week or so. Zelia, significant, small, very intense, I think notable for how quickly it developed. This is back in mid-February.
Yeah, it actually made landfall on Valentine's Day,
so right in the middle of February.
And as you mentioned there, yeah, really small but very, very intense storm. And I can give you my personal take on this one as well, because I was in Port Hedland in the lead up to Cyclone Zelia. I was there covering it, of course, for the ABC. And I'm doing live crosses early in the morning in the days kind of leading up to this. And the rain is so intense already that suddenly my earpiece and all the tech starts failing. So I'm on TV with my phone up to my ear, shivering cold, covered in mosquitoes. And that was just the start of it. It really was an incredible system. It was massive in the impact, but so small and isolated, and it really tore through the Pilbara at the start of the year. It was probably our big story for the year, even now in December.
How big a damage did it run through, particularly around Hedland? I mean, sort of, you know, that major port area.
Yeah, so it landed just east of Port Hedland. So luckily avoiding the main town, where the centre of the storm avoided the main town of Port Hedland. There was initially some forecasting that said it might actually cross over. So a bit of luck in the fact that it didn't have more damage. But as you mentioned, yeah, it was a very costly cyclone. $733 million
damage
and economic losses. That makes it the 8th costliest tropical cyclone in Australian history. I should mention that Alfred is the 4th that happened to over east. That is the 4th most expensive in Australian history. It made landfall near the De Grey River, which is northeast of Port Hedland, brought with it localised flooding and damage to Port Hedland. But the massive amount of impact was probably more isolated to the local cattle stations, De Grey and Pardew, with destroyed buildings there. People's livelihoods really put at risk. Some of those stations, De Grey and Pardew, both had rainfall over 3 days in excess of 500 millimetres, if you can believe it. Other stations receiving in excess of 200 mils. At the De Grey River near Marble Bar, it peaked at 10.23 metres, which beats the previous record by just under 2 metres. The days after is where we really saw most of that impact. The cutoff of the Pilbara highways and roads for days on end. Nick, as you know, there is one route that connects Broome with the south of the state, and that was cut off for a number of days. There was a really mammoth kind of delivery effort where trucks were heading from Perth with fresh food all the way across through South Australia, up through the Northern Territory, back across the Kimberley, just to get some supplies to Broome and to the Northern Kimberley area. There was a convoy of trucks that was escorted by main roads through flooded waters. So some really incredible sights to see. The system also caused the ports of the region to close. As you mentioned before, the port of Port Hedland is the biggest bulk export port in the world, as key export point for Australia's iron ore. That, as well as a few other ports around, closed for 3 days, which contributes a lot to that 700 million plus in economic losses.
The isolation is such a big deal as well. As you say, so many of these areas, you've got one road, and when that flooded, you are stuck where you are. So amazing to be through that. And I realise that sort of, it's a hazard of living in those areas, but it doesn't make it any less stressful for the people going through it. Look, the other story you've had that's had a huge amount of attention this year, internationally, I should say, government delegation, along with Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, off to Paris, lobbying for that incredible rock art to be added to the World Heritage List.
Yeah, this was a really incredible story and a big focus for us this year. As you mentioned, so this is the Murujuga cultural landscape that we're talking about. So for the listeners who might not know what that is, this is on the Burrup Peninsula, which is about 20, 30-minute drive from where I am currently, where our office is in Karratha. It's home to the cosy town of Dampier, some beautiful tidal white sand beaches. Also, really heavy amounts of industry, gas processing plants, iron ore ports. There is a fertilizer plant as well. But it's home to the Murujuga cultural landscape, including rock art, tens of thousands of years old. It's the largest collection of rock art in the world. Now, for decades, traditional owners here in the region, in the Pilbara, have been campaigning to get this cultural landscape inscribed on the UNESCO World Heritage List. That happened this year. They travelled to Paris in a delegation. There was a bit of concern that they might not approve it. They might not inscribe it on the World Heritage List. They did eventually unanimously approve that decision, but it came with the caveat that there needs to be ongoing protection and investigation of the impact of industry on that rock art. It kind of leads us into the bigger part of this story, which has been the Northwest Shelf, which is Woodside's gas project, the largest gas project in Australia. This year, the government was faced with the decision whether or not to extend the lifetime of that plant until 2070, so for another 35 years. They were initially supposed to make that decision well before this year's federal election. It was delayed a few times and put in the hands of the newly minted Environment Minister, Murray Watt. So it was in May that the Minister Watt did announce that he'd give conditional approval to the Northwest Shelf to continue in operation until 2070 with some strict condition. We got the final tick of approval months later in September with some of those conditions. But a question remains still over whether or not this World Heritage listing will have a big impact on the way that we manage and protect rock art here. There's been some further investment from state government and lots of work being done from the scientific community here. But amid all this, there's a lot of politics. There's been a lot of revelations and concerns raised this year that some of the reporting on the rock art itself, the scientific reporting, may be biased or may be amended to have a different change. Some researchers have suggested that key graphs and data were amended from the reports into the executive summary with a concern that it's telling a different story. So we still don't really know, the answer to the question, how much is the industry here impacting rock art and what more can be done to protect cultural heritage region? There's a question over whether the government's decision to allow Woodside to continue in operation was the right one. Proponents saying that it is going to be shoring up WA's economy, will provide jobs and millions in tax and royalties, as well as helping our transition to renewables, while critics again and again are saying how damaging this could be to our environment. It could be so damaging to cultural heritage, as well as Australia's international standing as a climate leader.
Charlie, it's going to be ongoing, but it's going to be one I think people are going to watch for a very long time. And I should say, we've saved one of the more unusual stories for last on this one. I was a bit surprised when I got to Karratha and learnt that we're the official station there for Christmas Island. It was a bit like when I got to Dubbo and discovered you're the official broadcaster there for Norfolk Island. It's just a little vagary of the ABC.
It is.
Yeah. It talked to me about Christmas Island because it's only got one canine living there on the entire landmass. Who might be the last one?
It is the last one. Shiloh is the last dog on Christmas Island. Captured hearts and minds this year. We sent a team out there to Christmas Island this year, and it was very, very great opportunity to get out there. So dogs, for the bit of a background, they were once eradicated on the island. The wild dogs were, and domestic dogs have been banned in order to protect the local wildlife. As you'd know, Nick, it's one of the most unique kind of biodiverse places in the world. Shiloh, though, she came to the island initially as an approved assistance dog. Her owner, though, has since moved back, but it was really expensive to relocate as well as quarantine restrictions, so Shiloh stayed behind. She's now bit more of a community dog. She brings joy to the local kids, the elderly there, anybody in the community who misses their dog or maybe would love a dog but can't because they live on Christmas Island. I know that she gets lots of pats, lots of treats. There's even a walking roster with local residents signing up to walk her and walk and pamper Shiloh. So definitely the last pup, but also probably the most spoiled pup on Christmas Island and maybe anywhere in Australia, Nick.
Charlie, how old is Shiloh?
8, I believe.
8. All right. So a few years?
Yeah, a few years left in her. But look, if she gets a lot more treats, I think we need to see if we can extend Shiloh's life, get her on a healthy diet, maybe some less spoiled treats and everything like that.
Especially a chocolate lab too, which they look a little roly-poly at the best of times, with all due apologies to any chocolate lab owners out there. Is the community pretty much on board, though, with this idea that it is about protecting that incredible biodiversity?
I think by and large, yeah, Nick. A lot of people who move to Christmas Island are there for the wildlife. You know, a lot of the opportunities there are in things like tourism, but also wildlife protection. It's, of course, a national park. And I think most people on Christmas Island do recognise the uniqueness of the place that they live. There's also been a story this year. They're still trying to eradicate feral cats on the island. And that has been a mammoth project that is nearing completion, but it's something that the community has really gotten on board with over this period. So I think, you know, if I had to make a guess, I'd say everyone is happy to have this rule of no more dogs on the island, but they're happy to have Shiloh.
Very happy to have at least one in there. And it would be very good to say goodbye to feral cats, particularly on a landmass like that, where it's actually doable. You can, on an island, actually make a change like that.
Yeah, no, it's really incredible, some of the work, and I'm talking to the team, our reporters Alistair Bates and Mietta Adams, who travelled to Christmas Island, and the awe that they got from that place, and just how impressed they were. It's made me want to go, Nick.
Charlie Mills, I hope you get to go there, and thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with Nightlife.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.